Welcome to Out of the Blank.
Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank podcast, an episode I'm especially excited for. Ed, please, for everyone out there listening, tell them a little bit about yourself. And I mean, just we'll get right to the topic, I guess, too.
Sure. So my name is Ed Martini. I'm a professor of history here at Western Michigan University, where I also serve as vice provost for teaching and learning and dean of Murray State College. And my scholarship has been on kind of the Vietnam War and the legacies of that for the United States, for Vietnam, and particularly as it relates to Agent Orange.
So what exactly is Agent Orange for people maybe of my generation or younger who don't like to read and weren't really around when Agent Orange was kind of at its peak?
Sure. So Agent Orange is a herbicide, one of six herbicides that were known as the rainbow herbicides that the United States and its allies used during the Vietnam War. It's basically a combination of two herbicides that were commercially available at the time, produced to specifications provided by the Pentagon. And the United States used Agent Orange as well as these other herbicides, Agent Blue, Agent Purple, Agent Green, Agent Pink, Agent White. Sort of the reservoir dogs approach to herbicides. And they used those for a couple different tactical approaches in Vietnam. One was to defoliate the landscape, to try to alter the landscape so it would be a little bit more hospitable to the style of fighting that the United States was used to essentially remove the leaves from trees. That's what the herbicides did. And then it also engaged in crop destruction missions, which was designed to target what they perceived to be enemy crops that the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong, would have access to. And so over the course of the war, the United States sprayed about 20 million gallons of herbicides across southern Vietnam, and about 62% of that was Agent Orange.
Now, with Agent Orange, for at least from what I've known about it, it was a lot of that was with the landscape, is that the Vietnam would hide in trees and other types of things around in the environment. So this was a way to kind of smoke them out. The issue that you can start looking up and finding out the horrible impacts of Agent Orange were that a lot of these troops that went right into those fields right after that chemical was sprayed. Now, I've heard some even exposure points, as well as the tents that people were guarding, for instance. They didn't even think about the leaking contaminants from the oil drums or whatever that they were keeping the chemical in. These people that were guarding these tents at different shifts or rotating around were exposed to the chemical as well, too. It didn't just have to be walking straight into the fields. I'm just curious, when did that notice of like, holy crap, we're starting to see a lot of side effects that are directly being linked to Agent Orange? Because when I spoke with Bartow Elmore, he said that the chemical names like Agent Orange, Agent Blue, Agent Pink, they all have these weird code names that are like very, very different, but you have to make sure you get the specific ones. So it's very, very hard to trace the exact that it came from this. And that might have been done on purpose. That might be a conspiracy idea. But that's, I mean, is there any validity to anything that I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So when they were being used during the war, most of the variations of those different kind of color-based chemicals, Agent Blue, Agent Purple, all those things, most of them contained a formulation of chemicals known as 2,4,5-T, which was a popular herbicide that was in use prior to 1965, when the United States escalated the war in Vietnam. The overwhelming use for 2,4,5-T in the United States and around the world was domestic agriculture. We sprayed that on crops. We used it to clear power lines and rail lines, ranch lands out west. So all this stuff was very much being used domestically even before the war. But then as the United States escalated the war, it also escalated its use of herbicides. So it would spray over these areas to try to, as you said, kind of smoke them out and make it easier for U.S. forces from the air and on the ground to locate and engage with enemy forces. What we find out later, kind of in the mid to late 60s, and then certainly after the use of Agent Orange has ended in 1971, is that 2,4,5-T contains a formulation known as dioxin, which is one of the most deadly chemicals that mankind has ever produced. And it's impossible to make 2,4,5-T without having dioxin in it. The chemical companies that were making this stuff knew about the dioxin contaminant at the time, but there's still no evidence that the government prior to, say, 66 or 67 had a wide awareness that these chemicals were in there. So Vietnamese troops, Vietnamese civilians, but then also U.S. troops were certainly kind of going through these areas that had been sprayed. But as we find out more about dioxin, and as we come back and start to study the after effects of Agent Orange after the war, what we find is that the most contaminated areas in Vietnam to this day are not areas that were sprayed or even sprayed repeatedly with Agent Orange or related herbicides. It's, as you suggested, Rob, as at these military bases and installations where the drums were stored, big holding tanks, lots of these 55-gallon drums that were then left to essentially leak into the soil. And so the groundwater and the food supply had been contaminated through that. And so people to this day who are living near some of these air bases in Vietnam still have significant issues related to dioxin exposure. And the troops who were stationed near those bases were likely more susceptible to health concerns than those who might have gone through an area even right after it was sprayed.
And there's still compensation programs for people that were exposed to Agent Orange that are still like disputes going on today about it. So I don't think they still have it properly figured out to be able to give these people compensation for that as well, too.
Yeah, well, it depends a little bit on what groups we're talking about, too. So in 1991, the United States passed a bill that gave U.S. veterans of the war far more flexibility and essentially said, if you were in Vietnam between 61 and 71, we're going to assume that you were exposed to Agent Orange. And then if you've got one of these list of conditions, which is now up to about 14 different things, we're going to allow you to submit for disability related benefits. So there's still a lot of bureaucracy and stuff that veterans and their families have had to go through. But U.S. veterans can get covered for a wide range of conditions that could potentially be linked to Agent Orange exposure, regardless of whether or not they were directly exposed. But we don't have the same kind of programs in place for, say, Vietnamese civilians or Vietnamese soldiers who were exposed during the war.
Now, was this an overall just like their last ditch effort of implementing something to win the war, or was this just the quickest way to react to what was going on to be able to retaliate and be able to get our troops there as fast as possible? So it caused them not to do a lot of studies on the basis of like contaminating their own troops in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it wasn't a last ditch effort. In fact, it was sort of the opposite, that it was instituted. Operation Ranch Hand is the operation that was responsible for most of the herbicide spraying. And that actually begins in 1962. So when the U.S. is still very much just having a slow ramp up to its forces, adding advisors, a lot of special forces, but long before the major escalation of the war in the spring of 1965, the Kennedy administration really saw the herbicidal warfare along with kind of the use of special forces, Green Berets, as an alternative, as a way to prevent a wider war. It was never meant to be done in concert with this massive escalation of the war after 65. But the Johnson administration continues both the use of herbicides and then the full intervention, sending in the Marines and eventually up to 500,000 troops in country and an escalation of the air war after 65. So initially it was meant to be an alternative to this widespread war, but it became done in concert with the two. But when we look back too, I mean, we have to understand Agent Orange a little bit in its historical context. And the way that we think about kind of chemicals and nature and the body today in the 21st century is very different than the kinds of questions and the kind of understandings people had back in the 50s and 60s. Like I said, most of these herbicides were being used domestically. People were spraying this stuff on their lawns and on ranch hands. And so it wasn't, or on ranch lands. So it wouldn't have been uncommon for them to not ask questions about, is this safe? Over the course of Agent Orange from 61 to 71, we learn more about that. The environmental group movement grows, books, Earth Day, Clean Air, Clean Water Act. There's a pretty rapid transformation of how we think about the environment, but it's very different at the end of the Vietnam War than it is at the beginning. So it's really not unusual that the military in particular wouldn't have been testing or asking questions about, is this safe for our soldiers or is this safe for the environment?
Now, with your just interest of coming across, like just doing research on the Vietnam War, why did you specifically choose Agent Orange to write a book about? Like, why did you target that? Like, did that one just pique your curiosity because you realized the disaster that it was, or was there something else to it? Like, you could even have a, there's probably positives to it. I just can't see, but I mean, it leads into another question I want to ask, where are you keeping up with it today? Like, is it a lot like Chernobyl, for instance, where slowly over time it's been able to, like, now we can go back there without serious side effects and stuff? Is it slowly diminishing at all, or is it just almost damn near impossible to get rid of every single bit of Agent Orange?
Sure. So in the first part, you know, why did I study Agent Orange? I did. When I went to grad school, I wrote my dissertation in my first book on U.S.-Vietnamese relations since 1975. I'm different generation than you, but I'm still in kind of that immediate post-war generation. I was born a few months after the war ended in 75. So I was always fascinated by it. And my first book was on U.S.-Vietnamese relations after the war was over, from about 75 to 2000. And so as I was researching that book, I began to learn a little bit more about Agent Orange, because it became very central to negotiations between the United States and Vietnam as they moved towards a more normalized relationship in the 90s. But I realized in doing that it was far too complex to kind of, you know, wedge into that book. I said, this is a whole nother topic. I got to come back and really do a whole nother study on that. And I found that there really wasn't that much scholarship, that many books out there on Agent Orange at the time. So I really just decided to try to kind of follow the trail and went in with a lot of assumptions about what Agent Orange was and what effects it had on both US soldiers and Vietnamese civilians. And what I found really was that the story was far more complicated. It's really interesting. It's really complicated. And it brings together a lot about kind of the history of the legacies of the Vietnam War, but also these shifting ideas about nature and the body and chemicals and the environment. So I just found like it was a really fascinating study and something that was piqued my interest and I thought would be hopefully a good contribution to more knowledge about the subject as well.
When you said you got, I guess you went into the complex kind of system or spider web, I would say that it is. What do you mean by that specifically? Like, because already in the beginning, when you mentioned Agent Orange, Agent Blue, Agent Pink, now, just from what I know about the government, I'm like, that's a great way to be like, well, which agent was it? Was it this one? Was it that one? Was it this one that you're looking for? That's where I start thinking of it, where I start wondering, is this part of what the complex, I guess, spider web you're kind of talking about, how it goes into all these different various interesting points?
Yeah, that was part of it, that it wasn't just Agent Orange, that Agent Orange was one aspect of this herbicidal program, and the herbicide program was one of many ways in which the United States engaged in some very kind of unconventional styles of warfare, especially early on during the war in Vietnam. You know, lots of use of different kinds of chemicals, this attempt to kind of master and alter the environment in a way that was more suitable to the American style of fighting than to, you know, the way the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam was fighting. But it does get more complicated than that, too. I mean, part of what I went in was, again, having seen, you know, popular media accounts about birth defects in Vietnam and knowing a little bit about all the health concerns that American veterans were dealing with, went in assuming, you know, the very worst about the chemical companies and about the government and, you know, having heard different kinds of conspiracy theories over the years. But I went looking for, you know, better part of 7 years for any document I could find in multiple archives in the US and around the world, and still couldn't find any evidence that the US government, the Pentagon, the White House, any high-level officials had any knowledge that Agent Orange or these related herbicides were potentially harmful to humans in general, let alone to US soldiers, prior to, say, 1967. So after, you know, multiple years of using these things, independent scientists began to raise more questions about dioxin, began to demonstrate clearly that it caused birth defects, caused a variety of forms of cancer in lab animals, so that it should probably be curtailed. But there's still no evidence that early on American officials knew that. And I know people, especially in the wake of Vietnam, always want to assume the worst. But as a historian, we have to go and kind of try to find the evidence and try to find the documentation. And it's just not there.
Do you think that there could be a little bit of, like, I would say, mistracking of writing down that information, or maybe someone took that part out of it just to not be liable? Or is that just conspiracy thinking in a sense? I mean, I understand the aspect of they were doing a lot of this stuff around themselves all the time, so they didn't know they were poisoning themselves. And we have more information on that now. But it also I can't think that we've advanced so far to where our thoughts are like, oh yeah, of course you don't want to put the chemicals in your food. That would be poisoning yourself. Like, someone had to have those ideas and there had to be studies about that, but were they properly looked into? It's just weird. You can't really find a record of like, oh, the government knew the harmful side effects of this. I think they really intentionally went in there trying to make sure that their eyes were closed in a sense of using this thing, because I mean, you're in a war, you're looking for any possible thing. And if one person brings up a point that might deter someone's point of dropping this Agent Orange in this field, then that might mess with your efforts when you're looking at the most fast and effective way to be able to neutralize the other side.
So I think there's an element of a little bit of those of both sides. And part of it is that were the war planners essentially somewhat careless in their approach and not overly concerned in general about what the effects would be on, US troops, let alone, Vietnamese civilians and folks like that. Absolutely. So I think there's an overall kind of recklessness where they didn't take a lot of care into consideration. They put US ground forces into unbelievably difficult situations. They prosecuted a very, brutal air war with some pretty indiscriminate bombing. And so a somewhat reckless use of herbicides, you might say, is part of that larger pattern. And at the same time, I think we also have to understand that our knowledge, again, about these chemicals underwent a pretty rapid and profound transformation between the early 60s and the early 70s when they were in use. So we have really clear documentation on scientists who worked for chemical companies knowing that dioxin was present in 2,4,5-T, knowing that they could limit the amount of dioxin that went into 2,4,5-T, and wanting to potentially do something about that. But there's no record whatsoever that they ever brought those concerns to the Pentagon. And so until these concerns became more public, with independent scientists, university scientists raising more of these issues and calling for independent studies and the suspension of herbicides use, not just in Vietnam, but more broadly around the world, that doesn't happen until more like 1966, 67. So the use continues after that point. But our ability to understand these things and the kind of ways in which we understood the relationship between these chemicals and human health or environmental health really changes exactly at this moment when they're in use. So I think it's possible that both things can be true, that it could be somewhat reckless and part of this larger issue where we didn't really care enough about our troops, let alone Vietnamese civilians, and also didn't know enough to maybe ask the right questions about the damage that these herbicides could do in the short term, let alone potentially long-term health considerations.
Who blew the whistle? Like, was it media exposure that really enlightened a lot of people on the side effects of Agent Orange, or was it just enough people raising a voice from the community, people like family members that were suffering from severe side effects of it? And what are the side effects? Like, I know it's got to be something with breathing, right? Your lung capacity probably has to be diminished. It's kind of like, was it COPD, where people can't really breathe? They get that from smoking, though, I think.
Yeah, it's less about that. More of the side effects have to do with a variety of kind of rare forms of cancer. Everything now, I mean, the VA list now for service-related disability benefits includes things like type 2 diabetes, prostate cancer, things that don't necessarily have a definitive link back to Agent Orange, but there's enough of a potential connection between the two that the VA has decided that they're going to give U.S. veterans the benefit of the doubt around those things. I forgot the first part of your question.
I forgot it too. Don't worry about it. We'll move on to the next thing. Have you tried, the whistleblower. Who blew the whistle on it? Did that come from media exposure? Yeah.
No, it's a good question. So U.S. veterans don't really start raising concerns and red flags really until the post-war period. You start to see an explosion of these concerns in the late 1970s, and folks working through the Chicago VA, there's a woman there named Maud DeVictor, who was a nurse at the VA and started seeing some of these really rare kind of health concerns for otherwise kind of healthy, youngish veterans who had come home from Vietnam, and they couldn't explain it. And they began to think and talk with some of the veterans and theorize that potentially Agent Orange could be responsible for that. And so for U.S. veterans, it really comes in the wake of the war. And then the vets launch a class action suit against the chemical companies and the government, and eventually in the early 80s, reach a major settlement in what at the time was the largest class action suit in U.S. history. But prior to that, during the war, we get some isolated stories coming from in country, in Vietnam, not from US soldiers, but from Vietnamese civilians, sometimes from like Red Cross and first aid workers who were on the ground and potentially seeing again some kind of rare things, raising questions about birth defects. But the closest thing we really have to sort of whistleblowers in this case are scientists, not just US scientists, but scientists around the world. In the mid to late 1960s, scientists began really confirming and documenting the worst fears about dioxin, which is this deadly chemical that's in the 2,4,5-T, which is one of the primary components of Agent Orange. And they start raising concerns. They start lobbying Congress, and the scientists become activists, not because they're opposed to the war per se. Some of them were, some of them were not. But because they began to see if what we're seeing about dioxin and if some of these concerns that we're now able to confirm independently are true, it could be having significant consequences for human and environmental health. And there, so kind of the international scientific community is as responsible as anybody for leading to the widespread suspension of the use of 2,4,5-T in the early 1970s, when the Nixon administration eventually suspends 2,4,5-T from you can sell it or use it in the United States, and they end Operation Ranch Hand in 1971.
Now, when it comes to tracking the record, maybe not going back before, but what happened after, have you noticed, like, what was the length of time where they started noticing that Agent Orange was a bigger issue than just using it as a chemical to fight with, but something that's actually infecting and it's actually very, very bad for the public health? Because I start to wonder, imagine if that was a 30-year thing, like you didn't know about Agent Orange effects for 30 years. So you decide we're going to research more into using this chemical in everything. And the next thing you know, we're in a society where there's a lot of people experiencing way more health issues than what we have now. But luckily, depending on what that time span was, they were able to do more research now and be more productive when it comes to trying to find out all the harmful effects of this type of stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because certainly a lot of damage was done in a fairly short period of time from, you know, the, let's say, the mid 1950s through the end of the 1960s with the use of 2,4,5-T and just our knowledge of dioxins in general, because there's a variety of kinds of dioxin out there and our knowledge about that expands pretty rapidly in the 1960s. But in a lot of ways, the period to action from widespread use in the early 60s through to the eventual suspension and banning of it is actually pretty fast in terms of a historical perspective. You know, if you look at what we knew and what we were doing with 2,4,5-T in Vietnam and elsewhere, even domestically in, say, 1961, 62, and to get to the point just 10 years later where we've effectively banned it and come up with pretty significant documentation proving that it could be both a carcinogen and a teratogen causing birth defects, that's in some ways, I think, a success story, that the scientists were able to validate so much of this information, get the, you know, the public and get government officials to be aware of that and lead to the suspension of its use. If you contrast that with, say, what we came to learn and what we know about cigarette smoking and the effects of that, I mean, it's a much more rapid transformation from this stuff seems fine to, no, this is a significant threat to human health, so we have to stop this now, in just a period of about 10 years. In some ways, that's a success.
Now, when it comes to that being the first kind of, I would say, large scale event of using chemicals for war, do you think that necessarily the studies weren't just about worried about the health effects that it does, but also trying to perfect a better method? Like, do you see any points of like interest where it would be used for more war conflicts afterwards without knowing the full scale identity behind what Agent Orange actually is?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, every war kind of has its own, you know, signature weapon or thing that we become known for. And I mean, there were other kinds of chemicals certainly used in previous wars, most notably the use of kind of gas warfare in World War I, which was pretty horrific. And certainly people knew exactly what the effects of that war would be. And that leads after the war to international, you know, prohibitions against the use of chemical warfare and some of the first kind of widespread international chemical warfare treaties. Nobody had ever really weaponized herbicides before. That was a new introduction to warfare by the United States and really hasn't been used broadly since then. But that hasn't stopped folks from, you know, I mean, we look now at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the use of burn pits around, you know, U.S. military bases, and now veterans from those wars are coming home. And I mean, it's different because burn pits weren't, you know, weapons used during the war. But, you know, I think part of what all this reinforces is that, you know, war is really bad for your health. I mean, it seems a really obvious point to make, but aside from just putting people in harm's way, we don't often think about the immediate, let alone the long-term effects of the different kinds of weapons we might use, the different kinds of chemicals we can be using, or the health effects or environmental effects of just, you know, U.S. military installations when we go around the world and set up bases and wage wars.
I'm curious too, when you start learning about all this type of stuff, did you notice anything besides maybe not being able to track back, I would say, data or pre-knowing of what the damage would do? Is there anything that you just couldn't, like, it seemed like it was a dead end? Like, is there any common correlations when you can look at, like, okay, well, I don't know the answer to that. It's kind of like JFK. Like, there's a lot of, like, unknown about JFK. There's a lot about, like, what's going on here, what's going on this. And everyone has, like, it's been linked to a conspiracy. I wouldn't say Agent Orange is a conspiracy, but I was curious to if you found any walls or anything that were like, why is this here? Like, there's no information past this point.
Not particularly. You know, when I went in and was doing research, especially in the National Archives, you know, in Maryland and DC, there's not a lot of stuff that I ran into, which you often do when you're doing kind of diplomatic history or military history, running into, you know, confidential, top secret, and stuff that still maintained a certain level of security classification, even 20, 30, 40 years after it was produced or after it should have been released. The stuff around, like, the Kennedy assassination, that there's still things, you know, what, 60 years later now, where occasionally go down a rabbit hole, but there was really nothing to indicate that, you know, all these files had been removed or all these things are still top secret or classified the way that we see with the Kennedy administration. Most of it, as far as I could tell, would be due to there was some maybe proprietary information in there from chemical companies who were doing certain things with specifications for there, but nothing I could find. I mean, if this was a conspiracy to say the government covered up the fact that it knew Agent Orange early on was going to be harmful to human health, this has been by far the best orchestrated conspiracy in the history of the United States. And I just find it hard to believe that many people could keep that big of a secret for so long.
Do you think that if it would have happened today, that they wouldn't have implemented Agent Orange? So if we were going to use Agent Orange, like if it was never used before, if we were going to do something of that scale, do you think it would be implemented that quick? Or do you think there'd be a lot more studies being done into it in the society that we're in now? Because that time gap from the 60s to now is completely different. For instance, like, I mean, it leads into another question, which is when you're researching this, a lot of kids that know about Agent Orange and the horrible impact that it had, they have a head in of like, this government sucks, we're going to expose the horrors behind it. But then once you start reading into it, it's like, oh, these people just didn't know. And there's kind of a lack of willingness to know in an aspect, which kind of you start to see points on both sides, which gives you, as a historian, you have to look at that aspect of things. You can't just go into it like, I'm going to expose the evil of the government. You got to go into it like, oh, this is like a take myself in the time period, they just didn't care to know. They wanted to win a war, and this is how they thought they could win it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Rob. You know, my job as a historian is to try to understand, you know, the decisions people made in the context that they made them. And that doesn't mean we excuse them or are trying to justify them. But, you know, in the early 1960s, I think there's two big differences, and both of them are directly related to the Vietnam Wars. One, as I said before, we have a very different understanding as a society about the relationship between humans, chemicals, health, all that kind of stuff about the environment. It's really when the environmental movement in the United States is still very early on, and there's pockets of it. It's clearly growing at that time, but it's not as widespread as it would be in the 1970s. And Agent Orange is part of that story. Similarly, as you said, you know, prior to Vietnam War, prior to Watergate, Americans' faith in government in general was significantly higher. But in the wake of Vietnam, in the wake of Watergate, those of us who have grown up in the post-Watergate, post-Vietnam environments assume that the government is lying to us. We assume the worst about it. And that's just, it wasn't as widespread as that. If you go back pre-Vietnam into the 1950s and 1960s and the post-World War II period. And so we've got to understand what we know about Agent Orange now and how we understand Agent Orange in kind of a popular sense, what we see in popular media and journalism, versus what we would have understood in a similar way now 50 or 60 years ago. And the understandings are just very, very different that we bring to it than folks would have brought to it at the time.
Do you think that there's any misconceptions that maybe you know the truth about that people really don't? Because like I said, any person my age or probably most of the general public that you turn on the news, it's never a good reporting about Agent Orange. And we're not saying that it is good. We're just saying that there isn't this transparency of like nobody really cared to look into it. You know, there was just this aspect of you had a war to win. Everything gets put to that line of government is poisoning you, and it kind of distorts the perspective a little bit. And I'm not a conspiracy person, like I entertain them at times, but I also can see the perspectives on both sides of things too. I mean, it's easier to do something when you don't know the full impacts of what that is and just apologize for later. As my old boss used to say, better to ask for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission. And I'm just curious if you've heard any like what you would call like myths or conspiracy ideas behind it and things that maybe you could set the record straight on some things.
The biggest and the most persistent one is that so many people are convinced that the government had to have known early on that Agent Orange and the related chemicals were bad. And again, there just isn't any proof of that whatsoever. That doesn't mean that they, you know, weren't reckless and like not asking questions and maybe not caring about what they were doing to some of the US troops and to Vietnamese civilians. The other thing that people assume a lot, because when you look at, again, popular journalism and more popular media images, one of the first images that will come up when you look at this is birth defects in Vietnam and like these horrible images of disfigured children. And part of what I did in the book was I also, you know, traveled to Vietnam and talked to folks on the ground there who are caring for what they call Agent Orange victims. And in some cases, these folks may very well be potential victims of Agent Orange. But the science around birth defects as they relate to potential Agent Orange exposure is actually one of the most contested areas of science. And it's really hard in any situation to determine that a particular exposure scenario to Agent Orange caused this particular disease. It's just not that clear cut and that linear a path. So what the United States effectively did with the Agent Orange Act of 1991 was give its own veterans the benefit of the doubt. If you were in Vietnam between 61 and 71, we're going to assume you were exposed to Agent Orange. And if you have one of these 14 conditions now, even type 2 diabetes, even prostate cancer, which a lot of, you know, older adult American males are going to get prostate cancer, does that mean that Agent Orange caused your prostate cancer? Probably not in most cases. But we've made a political decision and a policy decision and as a society to say, we're going to cover those benefits. We turn around on the other hand and say to folks advocating for more aid to go to Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange with the same conditions and say there's not enough scientific evidence to support your claims that Agent Orange caused your illness. So at a certain point, I think people want clarity. They want certainty. They want to know, I was exposed to this chemical and that caused this disease. And it's just not that easy to demonstrate direct causality in there. So at a certain point, the decisions become policy-based and ultimately they're political decisions. And it's not surprising that we might make different determinations about our veterans versus Vietnamese civilians. But I think people want a certain sense of like scientific certainty and clarity in these issues. And these concepts around Agent Orange are just, they're far muddier and far more complex than that.
Do you think that when you were down there reporting, like in Vietnam, or talking to people down there, do they see it the same? Like, do they see Agent Orange as like, because if you ask any, like I said, any American over here about Agent Orange, they said it was a horrible thing that we did. They say those words, we did. But there's all, I mean, you have to think a lot of millennials and a lot of things really just don't like the government. I'm a patriot at heart. But I just think that there needs to be better oversight on some things. But when it comes to over there, do they view it the same? Like we look at Pearl Harbor, for instance. I went to the Pearl Harbor Museum. It sparks up anger and pain and all these types of emotions. I'm curious to if they view that the same. If you walk over there and ask them about Agent Orange, do they view it like you horrible Americans, or do they view it as like, yeah, it's something that we're dealing with and we're coming out of it?
It's an interesting question. I think in general, I've been to Vietnam twice, once when I was writing each of my first two books. And what I was struck by both times was how forgiving and how open Vietnamese folks are to Americans coming over. Maybe a little bit more true in Southern Vietnam than in Northern Vietnam. But in general, the Vietnamese were ready to move on and normalize relations with the United States almost immediately after the war was over. It was really the United States that put up more roadblocks to cooperation and normalization between the countries after the war. So in general, Vietnamese were very forgiving, given the amount of damage that the U.S. kind of wrought on their country during the war. But around Agent Orange, there's definitely a significant sensitivity around that. And there are major groups in Vietnam, as well as certainly like individuals and families who believe that they have not had their day in court. They believe that they have not had justice because they look again at sort of the double standard when the U.S. government says like, oh, Agent Orange causes these conditions for U.S. veterans, which is not exactly what they say, but that's what they think. And then turns around and says those exact same things are not caused by Agent Orange for Vietnamese victims of it. So I think it's the lack of justice, a sense of injustice, more so than like, I can't believe what you did to me. It's that we haven't made up for past wrongs.
Now, have you dived down the rabbit hole of looking at anybody who might have the worst experience from Agent Orange? Like, because I mean, you could probably type it in on Google, like Agent Orange side effects, and you'll get a horrible top story. But have you ever came across one or heard one that was just the worst thing you've ever read or seen?
I mean, there were certainly some of the veterans who were at the heart of the class action suit in the late 1970s. These, you know, would develop these unbelievably rare forms of cancer and just some pretty horrific conditions that couldn't be otherwise exposed or explained. And even in those scenarios, you know, we never would know or will know for sure that Agent Orange caused those. But there were some pretty horrific things. So, you know, when I'm talking about these days, we don't know that, you know, Agent Orange is responsible for type 2 diabetes or prostate cancer in veterans 50 years after the war was over. But at the time, there were certainly some horrible effects from people who were pretty clearly exposed to high levels of dioxin. And we know from longer term studies in Vietnam for folks who are, you know, third generation, who have grown up around the former U.S. air base in Da Nang, which was one of the most polluted areas in the world because of Agent Orange storage for a long time. There were some horrible forms of cancer and potentially even some birth defects. Again, causality is tricky there. That regardless of what the cause is, are heartbreaking, you know, that people don't have resources, can't get healthcare, can't explain what this is, and young people, old people, whoever it might be, I mean, really severely afflicted. So at some level, regardless of whether it was caused by Agent Orange, you know, almost doesn't matter, but there are some really just heartbreaking stories for sure throughout the history of Agent Orange.
I'm curious about that because that question leads into another one, which is where were the people that suffered the worst or some types of these rare cancers, where were they stationed? Because like if we talk about like, yeah, walking into a field with that chemical being sprayed is going to get you contaminated to it, but also being around those drums 24/7, watching those things. If you're able to look at like what that person did on the air, if they worked at the airbase where those storages things were, you're going to have a lot more exposure to that raw chemical that's just leaking out in an aspect of just walking through a field where it was sprayed. It's kind of dissipating all around you. But if you have the focal source point, that's where you would see more probably. In my perspective or understanding, if you're a government agency giving out benefits, you're going to look to those people more when you find that information out rather than the people that just walk through the field. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what the government really struggled with in the early 1980s in the wake of this class action suit. They were trying to figure out how best to determine how troops were exposed and what that exposure scenario meant. And, you know, eventually they kind of threw up their hands and said, this is basically impossible. You know, even with good records, which sometimes we have, sometimes we don't, even with good memories, which sometimes we have and don't, it was really hard to determine where an individual troop was on an individual day 20 years prior and how much Agent Orange they might have been exposed to. And that's why we eventually come up with the Agent Orange Act of 1991, which basically just says we don't need to determine how you were exposed. If you were a ground troop in Vietnam, we assume you were exposed to Agent Orange. And then, you know, especially with the stuff around the bases being the most toxic sites, We don't really learn that until the 1990s, even after the Agent Orange Act of 1991. So a lot of time and energy in the early 80s went in with scientists and military officials and doctors trying to determine how we could best determine the significance of a particular exposure scenario and what that might mean for an individual veteran's health. But it was basically impossible to do so. And even in those scenarios, you know, the human bodies react very differently. Two people can be directly exposed to the same kind of Agent Orange scenario, and one of them doesn't get cancer, and one of them gets this horrific form of cancer that they can't otherwise explain. So even when we have good knowledge about the exposure scenario, there's really no way to link that directly causally to human health.
Do you ever teach your students specifically about this, but do you ever try and make sure that they don't receive it, like I was saying earlier about being like, screw our government and all this type of thing? Because for the very start of it, and like I said, for people that kind of have a little bit of knowledge from what media has shown them, that's how it's going to come off and that's how it's going to be received. I feel like you have to be an excellent teacher at the same time. You have to be an excellent historian in this aspect to know the full extents and perspectives of this to explain it to, especially how many kids are ramped up ready to protest or do something on those aspects as well too.
Yeah, we do that in general, certainly about a lot of stuff related to the Vietnam War. Students today are still very interested in Vietnam War. Anytime I teach my Vietnam class, it feels like that. Students want to understand it. They understand, I think, the significance that it plays in U.S. history. But part of our job when we're teaching history is to try to, again, put them back in that historical context. Don't look at this scenario with your 2022 goggles on. You got to go back and look at it in a 1962 lens. And so we look at actual decision points in Vietnam about Agent Orange, about the decision to escalate the war, about the decision to institute the draft, which is always a great one to talk with young people about, right? Because that would have affected them. If we had a draft in place tomorrow, and you're an 18, 19, 20-year-old college student, what would you do? Would you protest? Would you go to war? Would you go to Canada? Would you try to use your deferment? But in order to try to understand that, you've got to try to think like somebody in 1960 or 65 would. And that's the biggest challenge, is, you know, to go back at least two generations and try to understand how people understood the world and their society and the range of choices available to them at any time. But that's part of the fun of teaching too.
Well, with the lieu of Watergate and then kind of Agent Orange happening as well too, did you see any giant broadband community action of protests or types of drastic attack on the government because of these actions that were being done? Like I have to think there has to be not only research being more conducted into just Agent Orange, but an overall line that the government seems like they had to go back to because of the fact that people were just getting so insane. I mean, if you look at the old government history stuff, I don't want to be that person that's like anti-government, but like I said, if you look back at those things, there had to be a pushback point where a lot of people were like, there's a lot going on right now. I don't know. You know, you have to kind of sort through that. I'm just curious if you came across any points tracing after Agent Orange where there was any certain like lines that were really drawn from people's intervention.
There's less direct action and protest related to Agent Orange than around a lot of stuff. I mean, the Vietnam War is well known for having one of the broadest, largest, most diverse anti-war movements probably in the history of the United States. And that's in place from the get-go. It's before the United States even escalates the war. Baby boomers are the largest generation. They're all going to college in the 1960s, early 1960s, you know, in record numbers. And the anti-war sentiment from 1965 on is massive. Huge protests in Washington, D.C. in 67, 68, 69. I mean, really ramped up. Generally speaking, not a lot about Agent Orange at those times. Agent Orange was kind of an under-the-radar issue, and we learn a lot more about it. And it becomes much more of an issue from about 1977 into the 1980s, far more than it ever was during the war. People at the time, college students in particular, were more likely to point to napalm as a weapon that they were opposed to, and that really in some ways became the most, you know, symbolic weapon for the United States in Vietnam, and would protest openly against napalm, against Dow Chemical and Dow's presence on campuses, especially here in Michigan, where Dow was based, where there would be anti-Dow protests and looking at the intersections of chemical companies and universities for scientific research. So there was a lot more related to napalm at the time than there was to Agent Orange, which really comes after the war.
Now, when you were writing your book about this and kind of diving down deeper into the topic, did this calls you to maybe have interest more in genetic modifying of crops? Like, I feel like I'd be looking at all aspects of that too. Like, you hear about the government paying out, but who was the company that the government hired to be able to do that as well too? You know, I mean, that chemical was used on a lot of other things before it was just used for war purposes as well. So that causes you to be like, should the companies be liable? Should the companies have better studies done on their chemicals? And why didn't they have them at the time? You know?
Right. No, absolutely. And you know, the herbicides were in widespread use prior to Vietnam, and they get used for other things later on. But the chemical companies are clearly, people always want to point to the government as well. But we don't have evidence to say that the government knew certain things early on and covered it up, regardless of whether or not they asked appropriate questions. What we do know, we have great evidence on this that came out of the veterans lawsuit, that the chemical companies absolutely knew. The chemical companies producing Agent Orange for the Pentagon knew about the dioxin contaminant as early as 1965, and many of them knew about it prior to that point. They didn't do anything to alert the Pentagon, the White House, military planners to that effect. And that's why the class action suit that the veterans filed, eventually the government pulls out of that suit, but the chemical companies were sued and settled out of court for $182 million in 1982. But as part of that settlement, they didn't admit that Agent Orange was the direct cause of any of the veterans' health concerns, right? It was an out-of-court settlement where they didn't admit guilt. And we see those kind of things all the time. So I do think if there are some significant bad actors in the Agent Orange story, it's certainly the chemical companies. And, you know, that led me not so much about down the road towards genetically modified chemicals, but in learning more about the work that public health historians and other people had done about other examples of chemicals and their impact on human health over the years, and the kind of shifting role that the government plays over the course of the 20th century in regulating those chemicals or not regulating those chemicals. Where does the burden of proof lie? When do chemical companies have to show that their products are safe versus just showing that maybe they're not immediately harmful? There's a lot of great work out there that's given us different examples of that over the years. And I think those have as much in common with the history of Agent Orange as anything.
When we talk about its historical track or historical precedent, I would say, when we go to Agent Orange, do you think it's ever going to be a topic that's just going to go away and be part of our history? Or do you think it's just going to be something that's always going to be looming around? The reason I say that is I feel like this set the road for a lot of chemical companies. This set the thing for a lot of new studies to be done, especially if you're going to use chemicals in any type of environmental situations. This was kind of like the forebearer in a sense. But also, how many people that say like, oh, I was born with this defect because my grandparent was this in Agent Orange, and it was like a LinkedIn thing. There's always going to be traces just trying to grab money, obviously, or maybe they feel like they're rightfully supposed to get the money because they're trying to find a link that might not necessarily be there, connecting very, very far off dots. I just wonder if this topic is ever going to be something that's going to go away. And if it isn't, should it ever go away? I feel like it's a great historical thing to teach, but it's been implemented, and I think it needs to be done thoroughly and properly, much like you've explained on the show so far, is that it needs to be looked at. Like, there was a lot of parts on different perspectives that you got to take in account. And it's very, very easy to manipulate something of this magnitude to make it the most toxic thing again, where it doesn't maybe do the physical damage that Agent Orange did, but do the mental damage, where we have people that could be brainwashed to be like, everything is horrible, we need to, and it just, it leads down a really dark path in a sense. So I'm hoping historically, if it's going to be a part of our history forever, which it is, it's going to be something that is going to be a precedent for major innovation change, major innovation in people's lifestyles and perspectives of understanding time periods and the evolution of growth and thought. I don't know what your thoughts on that. It's a lot.
It's a lot. You know, history is a funny thing. What we're going to care about 50, 100, 150 years from now, when, you know, I'm certainly long gone, it's hard to say. What I would say is that the Vietnam War is always going to play a major role in American history. It's an important event in global history. If you look at the long Vietnam Wars from really 1945 to 1975, that's not going to go anywhere. And as we talked about earlier, napalm and then eventually Agent Orange both become sort of symbols of that war and its legacy. So I think to that degree, Agent Orange will always be part of the Vietnam War story as long as the Vietnam War is an important part of the story. I suspect for a little while, we'll see a little bit of a decline in the significance of Vietnam and its legacies after the baby boomers, you know, have died. And you know, it's really a pivotal point for their generation as much as anything. But because it's such a significant global event and a significant event in American history, I think it'll always be there to a certain degree. But what I'm not as confident or optimistic about is that Agent Orange will receive sort of the attention with attention to the nuance and complexity that I think is part of the story that it probably deserves. I think it'll probably get reduced to a symbol and like a shorthand for like what we did to our troops and what we did to Vietnamese civilians. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe it's not inevitable. But what I've tried to do in all my work on Agent Orange is show that it's a really complicated topic, and that what if you hear a simplistic explanation about what Agent Orange is or what it does, it's probably wrong because it's a much more complicated topic. But you know, how we'll deal with that 100 years from now, it's really hard to know.
During at any moment when you were researching this, did you just have to step away? I feel like it had to be a lot to absorb in, especially if you're just reading about not only the extents, but how tricky everything does. It has to mentally drain you as well as physically at the same time.
Yeah, it's a depressing topic. And I went from doing that, and I've since had to suspend work on it, but I started writing a global history of napalm after the Agent Orange book that I just haven't come back to. And it's just depressing topic after depressing topic after depressing topic. And you know, again, just regardless of what role Agent Orange played in it, so many of the histories and the stories surrounding this topic are stories of just pain and suffering and people looking for answers, losing loved ones, losing children, losing grandfathers, and just not knowing what to do about it. And yeah, it takes a little bit of a toll. So when you're in the archives doing the work, when you're writing about it, and even when you're trying to contextualize it without, you know, rationalizing or justifying it, it can be a little bit hard. But that's, you know, a little bit of the nature of the work too. It comes with the territory.
And any links do you have to your books? Anything else you're working on that might be new? If you got anything coming down the pike, or Twitter handle? You got a Twitter? Come on.
Sure, I do. I do have a Twitter handle. It's at @EdMartini3. I'm Edwin A. Martini III, so I'm the third of my kind, third of my name. So it's at @EdMartini3. The book on Agent Orange is called Agent Orange: History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. It's available certainly on Amazon and a lot of the other online booksellers. It's published by UMass Press. Nothing immediately coming out now, but certainly would suggest the Agent Orange book is a great place to start for folks who are interested in the topic.
And if you could have chose another topic besides Agent Orange, I got to know, you had to have something in the book. Like if you give me like bunny breeding or Agent Orange, I'd be like, bro, you, I mean, it's an interesting topic, but if you want to talk about your happiness, you got to go bunny breeding.
I know that was my joke for a while, is that the next book was going to be on, you know, rainbows and puppy dogs and everything. So I'm still working a little bit on napalm here and there, because again, it's a really interesting, complex global story. So it's not happy, it's not fun, but you know, it's an important topic with some interesting global legacies similar to Agent Orange. So maybe I'll get back to that book down the road.
I'll have to definitely get you on to talk about napalm a little bit as well, too. I bet there's probably a correlation just in, if you look at probably the strategies of how they implemented napalm versus how they implemented Agent Orange. I doubt they upgraded those methods. They probably used them the same way.
Well, the thing about napalm is people knew exactly what napalm was and exactly what it was going to do. And, you know, it was essentially a jellied form of gasoline that would stick to whatever it hit, including people. And we knew that and we used it anyway. So in some ways, it doesn't get as explained away as easily by the complexity or the nuance of the topic as Agent Orange does, which in some ways makes it, I think, more depressing.
Have you ever seen the movie Nine People You'll Meet in Heaven?
No.
I recommend watching that. It's the guy who played National Treasure, not Nicolas Cage, but played his father, that older man.
John Voight?
I think his name is that.
John Voight, yeah.
Yeah. He plays in it, Nine People You'll Meet in Heaven. But he was in the Vietnam War, and he dies. And when he goes to heaven, though, he's reliving all the people he's ever hurt. And one of them was a Vietnam soldier who he lit the house on fire. thinking that he saw someone in there. Then over after time, he thought, oh, it was just like a shadowy figure syndrome. He was adding that into his head, his imagination, and realized it was a little girl that he killed.
Oh my gosh.
And he has to wash her burns off.
Oh, wow.
And it, as he does it, she gets a clear face again, but it's like, it's a lot to do with the Vietnam War. Like yeah. That's where I first ever heard of Agent Orange. I watched it when I was like 6 or 7 or something like that.
Yeah, no, somehow I've totally missed that. It's not on my radar. So I will go track it down. Yeah. Thanks for the recommendation.
But I'll link all your links in the description. Ed, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, man.
Rob, thanks so much. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank.